you know, there's a common analogy for risk, explaining risk is like, hey, if you have a block of Swiss cheese, you can squirt the mustard and mayo and it'll pass right through those holes in the cheese, right? But if you slice it and you put a bunch of those layers on top of your sandwich, the mustard and mayo can't get through anymore because you've added too many layers of cheese, so the holes don't line up anymore. So it protects your bread from getting soggy. So these are risk treatments that we're adding to enhance the quality of our sandwich and lower our risk while we're doing inherently dangerous things.
We're talking about enhancing the quality of our safety sandwich today.
There you go. Exactly.
That's the tagline right there.
Yeah.
Welcome to All Aspects, a podcast where we explore, discuss, and celebrate adventure culture and outdoor lifestyle. It is our mission to educate, inform, and entertain our fellow adventurers about the inherent risks that surround us every time we go outside to play, and to provide you with the knowledge and tools to help you do the things you love the most in the safest way possible. All Aspects is brought to you by Aspect Abbey. Aspect Abbey is on a mission to save lives by making avalanche safety simple. It is the only app that tells you where the high and low risk zones are for today's avalanche danger. With a suite of built-in tools like forecast verification, slope meter, and gear checklist, Aspect Abbey is the new safety standard for avalanche risk management. Remember, there are dozens of apps that get you into the backcountry, but there's only one that's designed to bring you home, and that's Aspect Abbey. Go to aspectabbey.com to learn more or download the app to start your 30-day free trial. Thank you, Aspect Abbey, for making this show possible, and thank you for listening. All right, let's get to the show.
So Dave, where do polar bears put their money?
I don't know, Jeff.
Snowbanks, Dave. Snowbanks.
Oh, come on. I should have seen that one coming. Jeesh. Well, Jeff, what are we talking about today, man? This is your topic.
Oh, yeah. Let's do a deep dive into travel techniques.
Okay, cool. I like that. So, do you want to just give me a rundown of kind of what you think people need to know?
I think let's take a little Mythbusters approach to this, because a lot of times folks are making a classic mistake where they've chosen the wrong terrain, or they find out the snowpack is way more unstable than was forecasted. And they're like, oh, let's use travel techniques to make up for really poor terrain choices. And so you'll hear the classic thing of, oh, let's just ski it one at a time. It'll be all right. And you're like, whoa, 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 huge red flag. Great time to stop. The reason why we want to use travel techniques is to minimize our risk even further. We want to choose terrain that's in line with the avalanche danger and the problem types, that it's going to be low risk. But then the travel techniques we do are like a couple extra layers piled on top of risk mitigation. And it's super important to make sure we're clear on why we're using the right travel technique at the right time.
Okay, so you're saying that travel techniques can only be used in concert, you can't use travel techniques to circumvent bad conditions. They can only be used to like help you stay safer once you've already made other decisions to keep you in a low risk scenario.
Yeah. You want to be choosing the right
terrain
for the day's avalanche conditions. And then this is our last bit of risk mitigation that we stack on top. There's a common analogy for risk, explaining risk is like, hey, if you have a block of Swiss cheese, you can squirt the mustard and mayo and it'll pass right through those holes in the cheese, right? But if you slice it and you put a bunch of those layers on top of your sandwich, the mustard and mayo can't get through anymore because you've added too many layers of cheese, so the holes don't line up anymore. So it protects your bread from getting soggy. So these are risk treatments that we're adding to enhance the quality of our sandwich and lower our risk while we're doing inherently dangerous things.
We're talking about enhancing the quality of our safety sandwich today.
There you go. Exactly.
That's the tagline right there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well then let me ask maybe like a stupid question, but one that probably not everyone knows the answer to right off the bat to set the tone.
Yeah.
You know, do we ever want to go ski touring or go out in the backcountry alone?
Well, we need to choose the days appropriately. I prefer to ski tour with friends because it's very social. However, I will go out on some solo missions, and maybe it's just because I don't have much time, or I couldn't line up partners, or maybe I'm looking to spend some alone time. But keep in mind that if it's really cold weather or stormy, or we're out of communications, that could be a very serious tour in a hurry. So you may want to choose those days when the weather's good, it's not too cold, and maybe start off early in the day. So if something goes wrong, there's plenty of time for help to come get to you if you have a way of communicating with the outside world. So you may choose to go to one of your local areas that has good cell phone reception, that maybe other people are around, or you've got something like, say, a Garmin inReach where you can text out and get help on the way. But I'd be reluctant to, you know, the worst case scenario would be like super cold day, really bad weather, poor visibility, probably sketchy avalanche conditions as well. You're out there on your own and no communications. All of a sudden, that's becoming a really, really high risk proposition.
That's a super sketchy sandwich.
Yeah. But for like ideal group, usually three is about my magic number, because you've got two people to help.
Three total?
Yeah. Two people to help or rescue in theory if one person's hurt or gets avalanched. But it's also very nimble and it's just the right size socially as well, where you can often make decisions pretty quickly and reach consensus much easier than, say, a group of like five or six people. Large groups are really tricky to manage unless there's a clearly defined leader. If I'm guiding, there's a clear hierarchy and it's a lot easier to facilitate discussions because I take a leadership role. But often in a group of friends or peers, if you've got like six people or more or five, it can be quite awkward and people have a hard time navigating that. And just the size of the group actually becomes pretty unwieldy. And it's hard also to implement some of the travel techniques that can up our safety margin as well.
So the size of your group is part of the travel technique in itself.
Yeah. And to be honest, like if it's a day where conditions are a bit sketchy, I'm really not psyched on being in a large group. I'd much rather be in two groups of three and just say, hey, you guys go that way, we'll go this way, and we'll keep in radio contact.
We'll meet at the top.
Or, you know, just choose really reasonable terrain that's got a big safety margin. So, you know, you can expect if you're in a group of four or more, stuff's going to get squirrely. And the likelihood of miscommunication or making aggressive decisions goes up really fast.
Wait, so when you say stuff is going to get squirrely, what are you referring to specifically?
Oh, just the human factor traps. It's much harder to make a decision and reach a consensus in a large group. So you'll often start leaning on the classic human factor traps we've talked about in a previous podcast. And they'll get turned right up because it's really hard to have a framework for get everyone on the same page. Shameless product plug. If you've got Aspect Ava, you can all be on the same page and say, it says here that's red. Let's not ski the bowl. Let's ski the line on the ridge. Sound good? All right, everybody on board? Let's do it. And then that can really facilitate it.
So it's just that consensus element that's the more voices in there, the harder it makes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you ever cook dinner with five people, I mean, it's madness. You know, two people.
Too many cooks in the kitchen.
Two people is about right. Maybe three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, then let's jump into it. Let's start with uphill travel.
Okay.
Like right off the bat.
So how do you move your group through the terrain? And lower your risk as much as possible.
Yeah.
So one of the classic things would be if you're moving uphill and you're on the skin track, you would space out a bus length apart. And that seems really simple, but it's amazing how really intelligent people struggle with this concept. And what happens is it's fine when you're cruising uphill until you get to switchbacks. And if it's kick turns, it totally falls apart. So if this is our kick turn, if I'm in the back and you're in the front, I need to maintain that school bus length, not on the skin track, like where if you were dragging a string, But yeah, there's a circle of stress that you're putting on the snowpack and one I'm putting on the snowpack. We don't want those to ever overlap.
You don't want the Venn diagram of snow stress to start happening.
That would be the Venn diagram of doom. Yes, that'd be very unfortunate.
The doom diagram.
Yeah. And the reason why we're spreading out as a standard precaution, we've hopefully chosen low risk terrain for the day, avalanche conditions, but we're further adding on those slices of cheese, that was risk treatments, by spreading our weight out. And so if there's a landmine at a weak spot, like particularly with an old snow problem, if we've got five of us all crammed up together talking, we're putting so much stress in one spot that we can penetrate that through the snowpack a lot deeper and possibly trigger a weak layer down that, you know, if you're just moving along one at a time, that you wouldn't be able to affect. Like if I jump up and down right now, I don't know, maybe I can create 300 pounds of force, something like that. But if all five of us are jumping up and down, maybe that's 1500 pounds of force. That's a lot different. So that would be the classic is, hey, just as a standard, you know, operating procedure, if we're going to be an avalanche terrain, we're going to spread out a bus length apart on the uptrack here. But I've been in situations where the decision was, you know what, we can't go forward anymore. We're probably going to have to dig in for the night. And that's what's going to make the most sense.
So if you're in that situation, why couldn't you just ride the skin track out?
Oh, yeah.
If you've already made it that far.
Yeah, that's a great question. You might be able to, but maybe conditions changed.
Okay.
Yeah. Like the storm came in.
So that'd be like if you were in the middle of something.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like what's in front of you, like a shooting crack went off in front of you. It's like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
We're surrounded now by high risk.
Yeah. We had our mental model coming in, but now, as the dude would say, new shit has come to light, man. And you're like, okay, we need to change our actions. And it's like, hey, you know, a lot of times when you're in Europe, and they have readily available helicopter rescue, they're so psyched to have you call before you have an accident. And they're like, yeah, sure. We'll come winch you out. It's okay. We'd much rather winch you out when you're healthy than dig you out after you've been buried.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to move people who are not injured.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, one exception to the rule of spacing out when you're an avalanche terrain on the skin track would be, let's say it's rock hard corn snow in the morning, and you've dug down with your ice axe or your boot heel, and you're like, we keep digging and we're on 6 inches of frozen corn. It's rock solid. And there's like half inch or 1 inch of thaw. And then by all means, you can bunch up, be very conversational. Or another exception would be, you know, you might only be an avalanche terrain for a very short section of the skin track, and that's the only places you spread out.
Right, because when we go touring, we're always like within conversational distance of each other until it gets to that 30 plus degree terrain.
And then it's super important to have radios so that you're going to be spread out and it's going to be hard to communicate. And particularly if I'm not very fit and I'm off the back and I'm just recovering from the flu and I get a collapse and a shooting crack, and I'm like, hey guys, and you can't hear me because you gapped me off the back. You know, we need to be able to communicate. So radios are pretty clutch for that.
So I have another question. What, you know, a lot of times when we're looking at, you know, when we'll see a skin track somewhere, it'll be like an old logging road or something. A lot of times just because of that bank above where they cut a road, that'll actually be more than 30 degrees.
Okay.
You know, just that short bank, and that could easily slough down in on you.
Yep.
But we don't necessarily space out in those scenarios. Can you explain to me like sort of why the difference in that is?
Yeah, sure. Let me paraphrase it back just to make sure I'm hearing it right. So if you're on a pretty uniform slope and it's a like high 20s, but it's not avalanche terrain, but then we come along a road cut and there's a slope that's way over 30 degrees that could avalanche, you're saying, hey, what do you think about spacing out there? Is that accurate?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, there've definitely been times where, we're on a road cut using it to hike up.
Yeah.
And we know that hill that's above us is much more than 30.
Yeah.
Is it just because we're on that flat cut?
Yeah. So
that it's okay for us? Like we're not worried about remote triggering in that sense?
Well, there's two things going on. Let's handle them one at a time. If it's just a short road cut above me, I need to use some judgment and expertise and decide, is this a D1 or a D2? D1 means harmless to humans. So, the Swissies, for instance, they say, look, and the Austrians say, look at the slope of 20 by 20 meters. So it's about 70 by 70 feet. Personally, for me, that's actually a lot of snow. And if you think of a roof that's like 70 feet by 70 feet and that slides on you.
Dude, that'd mess you up.
That'd mess you up. Yeah, it's a little bit big for my taste. So I think for me, that size is more by 30 by 30 feet, something like that.
Okay.
And I'm like, hey, you know, that's a D1. And if we trigger it from the road and it comes down on top of us, it's pretty harmless. Okay. There are some exceptions. Okay. Like if you're in a gully where there's no place for the snow to go and it builds up super deep, that could be a problem. But I think the more nuanced question you're driving at is, let's say like where we live in Crested Butte, Kepler Pass is a summertime road. And there's a lot of road cuts above us that were bulldozed and they're quite steep, but they're short. But you're like, whew, I wouldn't want that to fall. I mean, that's kind of in the 30 to 40, maybe even 50 foot size slope. But where it becomes incredibly hard to trigger that from the road is when that road is snowmobiled and snowcatted and pounded into concrete. There's no weak layers there.
Right.
So this is pretty fine nuance. And, you know, if I'm on that main corridor where it gets pounded by snowmobiles and snowcats every single day of the year, it's highly unlikely I'm going to disturb a weak layer that could bring that road cut down on top of me. But where it gets
started, like, unless you went and romped up the hill.
Yeah. Asking for it.
Like cut it. And then it could all come down on you. But if you're on that hard packed room, the weak layer is gone at that point.
Exactly. But you know, that might be a case where you may choose to spread out. If you're like, hey, you know, there is risk from people triggering from above, other snowmobilers or riders out there. So let's go ahead and space out here for the unexpected. Where it gets really nuanced though, is where it gets tricky is a lot of times hut approaches will be hammered out if you're right on the skin track and it'll be on a summertime road. And as long as you stay on that narrow path, maybe 3 feet wide, the likelihood of you triggering a weak layer is really low because it gets so much traffic. A couple times a week, people are packing that down. But if you get a little off to the side, you're like, hey, Dave, I'll catch up to you. I'm going to pull off the trail and take a leak. That might be enough to get off the packed down skin track or the old ski tracks that come out. And I could affect that weak layer and trigger the slope down on top of me and the rest of the team. So that's where it's like, whoa. How much confidence do I have here in that I'm on the skin track or on the old ski tracks that people ski downhill coming out? That's cutting it pretty fine. And I'd rather not take, or I'd rather have a larger buffer for risk, I think.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
Yeah.
we just covered uphill. And you just taught me something about the dangers of the off tour track danger P that I never even thought about. But now it's time to talk about travel technique on the downhill.
Sure.
So once we get up to the top and we've transitioned into our downhill mode, we make sure that our boots are no longer in walk mode. Then what? What's our next move?
All right, cool. So we want to choose a line that has high rewards and low risk optimally. And when I say low risk, I mean, hey, is this a survivable run out? Or are we going to get raked over the cliffs, through the trees, into a gully? Yeah. So, you know, again, it comes back to terrain first. Let's choose a low risk terrain option for the day's conditions. And then let's add those layers of risk treatment. So our travel technique, we're going to ideally ski fall line and then do a 90 degree turn out to the right or to the left. So that if something comes down, we're out of the line of fire. and we want to be riding one at a time when we're an avalanche train on the downhill. And radios are pretty clutch to be able to communicate back and forth. Like waving poles just doesn't cut it. Particularly if I'm like, oh my gosh, I just got a massive collapse down there. And if I'm trying to like wave that with poles, like my old style Navy ship signaling skills are not that strong. I think they're probably just going to think, oh, Jeff's really excited. It must've been really good riding. Let's go.
Let's go.
Yeah. So one at a time, and you want to position yourself out of the line of fire. So one question that people often have is how far down the pitch do we go? And unfortunately, there's very few hard and fast answers. You could imagine with a very large peak, say 3,000 vertical feet, if you wanted to be fully out of the runout zone, you might be 2 hours away if someone gets buried up on the slope and you'd have to skin all the way back up. You're so far away. So you have to kind of split the balance of choosing where to regroup with our travel techniques. And ideally, for the day's avalanche size, you've gone down far enough that you should be out of the runout, and then you've gone off to the side at 90 degrees, so you're not under the line of fire. And it's funny, people often have a hard time staying disciplined. We're social creatures, and so we'll often, instead of staying, farming tracks and then doing that 90 degree hockey stick at the bottom, they'll just shoot the hypotenuse and go right at the first person or the guide. And you're like, I don't want you riding in on top of me. You're going to avalanche me out.
I am not a target.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, often if I'm going to be headed fall line and then ski to the right to get out of the line of fire, I'll say, hey, stack your tracks to the left of mine, keep them snug, and then come over with a hockey stick at the end. And that's a great way to manage your group. Another great tactic.
Wait, can I ask you?
Yeah, sure.
Can I ask you a question about, if you're going to ski a bowl, right?
Yeah.
A lot of times, especially what you just said, you're going to ski it in stages, like maybe 1,000 feet or something like that. So how do you choose your sort of hockey stick punch out if you're in the middle of a huge bowl? Like what are we looking for?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's very much situationally dependent, and it's a really complex challenge. So let's try to give you some guidelines to go with here. The first part, of course, is this a survivable line? Like, I'm not really into skiing closeout lines, to be totally honest. Like, that's maybe 1 or 2 days a year when the conditions have been low danger for a while. Sure. So that'd be first and foremost. But oftentimes you're looking to avoid potential trigger points like rocky areas or maybe a steep rollover and gravitating towards a smooth, consistent planar slope. And when I say planar, just think of like a book tilted on its side at 35 degrees, where I'm unlikely to find facets near bushes and boulders, and I don't have a big rollover. It's a smooth, uniform slope. That is optimal. That's what I'm aiming for. Those are the lowest risk slopes. So I'm further adding more risk treatments to increase my margins of safety. So I'll look for that. And then if they're saying, hey, the expected size today are D1.5 to D2, so relatively small, I'll be like, okay, let's factor that into how long of a pitch we're going to ski and how far to the side do we need to move out of the way. And if we can find a lower risk regrouping spot, that's optimal. And that would be something like a band of old growth trees that's clearly not been affected by avalanches. It's usually like a kind of like a little ridge that sticks up out of the bowl, so the snow would flow around it. That can be a great little low risk regroup spot. There used to be a phrase that made me bristle called islands of safety. And, you know, there's plenty of islands in the Pacific that are not really safe anymore because of global warming and rising sea level temperature. You know, like it's you got to be really careful about using the term safe. It's more like, oh, that's high risk. That's right in the gut where it's going to get funneled. Or that's lower risk because that's out of the line of fire and it's raised up. And for the D1.5 to D2 size avalanches they're talking about today in the bulletin, it's a pretty reasonable bet. And I'm trying to balance that okay. with, I could go much farther out into the bowl, but if somebody in my party gets avalanched, I can't help them because it'll take me 2 hours right. to get back up.
And you always, you know, like, I guess we've never really talked about this, but it always seems like unless we're skiing glades where there's no chance of being able to see someone, you usually want your regroup zone to be within visual line of sight.
That would be optimal.
Of the people at the top. So you yeah. can see the whole line someone's skiing.
Yeah. But to be fair, sometimes, like, let's say you're skiing a narrow couloir, the lowest risk place is tucked up under the cliff's wall, and I'll be holding onto the rock, like, not like, you know, a couple meters away from the rock wall. If it breaks at the rock wall, I want to be right where it breaks.
On it.
Or if slough comes through from the other riders, I want to be tucked up out of the way. So a travel technique, when you're skiing really steep pitches or in a couloir, is you have people stack in below the guide. So come in below me instead of above me. Because if you come in above, you're going to slough me out. So they would ride down fall line and then do the hockey stick and come under me.
Right.
And then I'd be like, hey, should right we... up against the wall, hand on the rock.
Yeah. Should we dispel a myth real quick about, you know, like if one of the reasons that hockey stick is so important, or just that, you know, getting out of that zone is so important, is just because one person drops in, say the first person goes and drops, nothing slides. Second person goes and drops, nothing slides. But that third person, it could still slide.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee.
Exactly. Yeah.
I feel
it's
like
not
that's
like,
something.
Hey, I'm the fourth person to ski this slope. I'm going to turn my beacon off and save the batteries.
Yeah.
And particularly when you're dealing with an old snow problem, just because there's tracks on the slope doesn't mean anything. You can see a slope littered with tracks, and someone hits the landmine, you know, a super weak zone near rocks or shrubs, and boom, they kick off the avalanche. Where it's less likely to have a problem is if the primary problem is sloughing. Usually the first person through will clear out most of the slough. And then to some extent, wind slab and storm slab. Usually, if you're on other people's tracks and you're dealing with wind slab and storm slab, they're going to clear it out ahead of you. It's not a guarantee. It's just much more likely that the first person would encounter the problem, kick it off, and then the people behind them are less likely to.
So what would happen? Let's just say this. What happens to our group if we ride that first pitch and, you know, we get to our low risk regroup zones, let's just call it like some old growth trees, like a little island there.
Yep.
And then the last person coming down triggers something, like they don't get hit, they get out of the way, they're good. Then what's our move for that next pitch?
Oh, and they just triggered something? Whew. I mean, Hopefully we're in the
is that like call a heli? Like, is that like what you're talking about? Or like, what do we do there?
I mean, it's a tough call, but I've been in a situation before in Chamonix where it was a moderate day. And we had skied steep powder all day, like steep couloirs. And I was with a couple other IFMGA guides and the world free ride leader on a snowboard. So it was a really strong group. But when we went up the Midi, there was way more snow than we thought. It was super light and it had been really wind affected. So there was, I would say, a meter 30 of snow. And it was incredibly sketchy. And we were like, whoa, okay, let's just ski a mellow line down the glacier. And as we get lower, should be less wind affected and more reasonable. Well, we got lower and it actually got worse. And we were just kicking off avalanches left and right on any slope steep enough to slide. And they were relatively small slopes. And we're like, okay, all right, let's just ski cut close to the roll and it would trigger below us. And then we'd ski the pitch. But at some point I was like, hey guys, this is actually totally different than we thought. It's conditions are getting less stable, not more stable. It's actually more wind affected the lower we go. I've never seen this happen before. It's clearly not moderate danger. I'd say it's more like high danger. And we're going to get to a choke point where it's going to get too steep and we're not going to be able to go any further. unless conditions miraculously turn around. So our options will be call the heli or dig in for the night. And so as we got to the rollover where it got to really steep terrain, I was like, we got to stop here and we're stuck. And so we called the heli and they said, hey, we can't come get you right now. The conditions have been really surprising today and we're responding to a lot of avalanche rescues right now. You may have to dig in for the night. And we were like, okay, we've got our space blanket, bivy sacks and extra puffy coats. It'll suck, but it'll be okay. And so we were just about to do that when my colleague was like, hey, let me just stomp this. And it, the whole bowl ripped wall to wall. It was like a D3.
No way.
Because we could see the hut where we were trying to get to, but we just couldn't get there. And so it was so extreme, the wind loading, that we were standing on blown out old moguls. And so on one ski, he was on a mogul, like from earlier in the week. And on the other ski, triggered the avalanche, which was about 4 to 5 feet deep, because it was so wind loaded, and the whole thing ripped. And we're like, well, I guess we can ski to the hut now because there was no snow left. I will say was just dumb luck. And I wouldn't advise anyone to try to take that kind of risk. And then right as we got to the hut, the heli comes in and he's like, I thought you said you guys couldn't get to the hut. And we're like, take a look at that slide. We couldn't, but then we got lucky that we were able to trigger it with one ski on a mogul and one ski just barely touching the wind slab. It was so hypersensitive. And
wow, especially with that thick of a slab, man. That's crazy.
Oh yeah. It was some of the most extreme anomaly conditions I'd ever seen, because we'd been skiing steep lines all day around the valley and there was no wind slab whatsoever. It was remarkable. And those unique,
I mean, this isn't exactly in that vein, but it sort of trends this a direction, which is like, what are some tips for traveling if you're in a place that you know is pretty highly traveled by many different groups in different areas, but kind of all in the same zone? Like, what are things we want to look out for? Like, obviously people bringing something down on top of you.
Okay.
Like, if you see people up above you, you want to make sure that you're like out of their run out zone.
Oh yeah. And we want to make sure we don't kick off anything onto other people below us. And that can be pretty tough when there's competition for resources. And particularly if you're in a crowded area that's off piste where you've got lots of people coming off the lift, can be really tough to be like, hey, I don't want to be responsible for getting someone below me avalanched. I'm going to wait because there's more people coming in and they may not wait for you. So in that case, it's probably terrain selection. If it's kind of sketchy out and there's lots of people around, I don't want to be there. I don't want to be there. I don't want to get hit from above and I really don't want to hit anybody below me. So we might consciously choose to go somewhere else.
So basically the only hot tip for that one is just choose your terrain wisely.
Yeah. Try to be out of sync with other people.
Let's wrap this one up with some key takeaways from people.
I've got one more for the downhill.
Oh, great.
Okay. And oftentimes if you're skiing in like say thick old growth forest, like you said, you may not have real good visual. So making sure when you're in the forest that you pick your regroup spots in a similar manner as you would an open bowl, meaning I'm not going to ski right below you and say, okay, Dave, I'm good. Come on down. I want to ski fall line and then kick out hockey stick to the side. And it might be tough for us to see each other, so radios are key. The other thing that can be really helpful is when you're in an old growth tree strand, do you want to be on the uphill side of the tree or the downhill side of the tree?
I think you want to be on the uphill, right? Because technically you want to get pinned.
Yeah, it's better to get pinned than to get flushed. But ideally what you'd have is a copse of old growth trees above you that would help deflect any avalanche debris if you're not out of the line of fire. And a couple really big trees below you, so you're pinned and you can't get swept away.
So you never want to select the first tree if there's a bit of a clearing. You want to be two or three trees in.
Yeah.
To avoid that.
Ideally.
Taking the brunt of a slide, ideally. Essentially.
And when you're in a group, I sometimes have to be a little bit of a tree Nazi and whack my clients with a pole and be like, hey, you need to get right up to that tree on the uphill side and be like there to hug it. Because I don't think this avalanche is going to break, but guess what? No one ever thought they were going to get avalanched. And plenty of people do get avalanched in the forest. So we need to be adding our risk treatments. So we're going to ski one at a time, get out of the line of fire with our hockey stick, be on the uphill side of some very large old growth trees, and hopefully have a bunch of trees above us to deflect any snow. And everybody needs to get on board and grab their tree and be like a big huggable tree so that their bindings are right up against the tree. Because you wouldn't want your tails up against the tree, because if you get flushed, you'll just get spun out of there and you're gone.
Right.
You want to be like, here's the tree, here's me. Yeah, I'm right here. Or and like some branches to hold on to ideally as well.
Why, you know, I think there's a misconception that skiing in the trees is safer.
Sure.
And isn't it really, I'm sure you can probably elaborate on this, but my understanding is that the only reason, or the only time that's true when it means it's more unlikely to slide, is when trees are so thick that you're getting those bombs pretty much dropping.
Yeah, that's right.
All, like, so consistently that it bombs out that weak layer. But if it's thin enough to ski in a fun way with sort of any velocity, that means that there's not that consistent breakage of that weak layer, right?
Yeah, you're real close. Let me clear it up. So when people say, hey, let's ski in the trees, oftentimes that means a variety of things to people, meaning, hey, I can't see so well because it's nuke and snow today. Like, let's have a couple Christmas trees, Charlie Brown Christmas trees to mark off of visually. That does not help you. In fact, those are just obstacles to get pushed into and broken up with. So we've got a spectrum of a wide open glade, not so great, to old growth forest where you have to be an expert rider to ski through. That's pretty good. And then super tight trees that are almost, that are basically impassable. If it's impassable to skiers and snowboarders, it's highly unlikely that that slope can ever slide. It's just so broken up by the trees that you can't get a cohesive slab. Think of like a birthday cake. Those are slabs, and they stick together. You got cake, icing, and then cake layer. You know, if that slab tries to break off in super tight trees that are too tight for me to ride through, it just can't really hold together and fail altogether. And then when you're dealing with an old growth forest that requires expert riders to ski through, it's wide enough for the expert to have a lot of fun and open enough. But like you said, the tree bombs break up those weak layers. And we experienced that last week when it was super sketchy out and we were able to remotely trigger from the flats, three avalanches. But when we were in the old growth forest, no signs of instability whatsoever, not even on the road cuts that were like 45 degrees. We thought for sure we'd pop them off. It was super sketchy. We were like 500 meters from the zone where it went from considerable where we were to high danger. I mean, so it's really touchy out there. And because of all the tree bombs, like you described, we couldn't see any signs of instability. And we toured for probably about 5 kilometers through that forest. The other factors that come into play are the branches inhibit surface ore. So we're not going to see the frost hit the ground, hit the snowpack. It's kind of like if you put a blanket over your windshield, you know, the frost just can't get to those bottom layers. And so it doesn't end up in the snowpack. And then the other thing it prevents is wind slabs from forming. You just don't get them in the deep forest. So that would be my optimal place to ski to maximize skier enjoyment, because we're not skiing wind loaded snow, wind slab. And it's much, much safer often because the weak layers are broken up by the tree bombs. But if it's a wide open glade that, say, an intermediate skier could ride, whoa, I'm going to think long and hard about that, because now that slope is much more dangerous than a wide open, smooth slope if you got avalanched. On a wide open, smooth planar slope, your likelihood of surviving in an avalanche goes up compared to crashing through a whole bunch of trees.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. rather than getting raked through a forest.
Oh, so there's and then there's one more strategy that comes in handy for skiing in the forest, and that's okay. The leapfrog. So I might ski to the rollover so I can see my team above me and I can see my team all the way below me. Whereas at the top, once a skier goes over that rollover, they lose contact with them. So I'll say, hey, I'm out of the line of fire. I did my hockey stick, but I can see the top and the bottom of the run. I'm going to call my team in one at a time on the radio. Radios are pretty key. And be like, okay, Dave, come on in. You roll in all the way to the bottom and do your hockey stick at the bottom. And I'll be the air traffic controller. And when I see Dave's in this low risk regroup zone, I'll send the next rider.
So the main takeaway of this whole thing is radios are key.
Yes. I can't believe there were decades where I skied without them. I mean, that was just nuts.
What did you do before? I mean, we're going to go off on a tangent here, but
did a lot of waving with poles and people would be like, what? And yelling. I mean, it just doesn't work. And, you know, the thing that changed my mind was I was doing my French recyclage. So if you're a French guide, every 6 years you do your retraining. And they had some consultants who came in and said, hey, we work with all kinds of high risk professions. And that might be emergency medical services, helicopter rescue teams, military, firefighters. And you mountain guides are the only group that we work with that don't have headphones or don't have a radio to communicate. Why is that? and I just thought about it. I was like, because it's like one more thing to hassle with and it's kind of heavy and I have to keep the batteries charged. But I didn't really have a good reason. And I don't think there is a good reason, except, you know, it's just a little bit annoying and it's one more piece of kit to faff around with. But, you know, it's a small price to pay for the benefits, particularly if you're trying to coordinate a rescue. Let's say I'm at the bottom, the team's on the top and the buried victim's in the middle, trying to coordinate what we're going to do. It's almost impossible if we have to scream at each other.
Yeah, true. Now, that's so crazy to think about. I don't think I've ever, like, I think radios have always been a part of my backcountry experience.
Well, maybe like, working with
film crews, really good ones.
Making with film crews, but you have to coordinate and you're just like, we're not going to use pole waving to try to coordinate a film shoot, let alone an avalanche rescue.
Yeah, well, that is truly ridiculous when you're trying to be like, go. And then they're like, what? And you're like, ready. And they're like, rolling.
Whoa,
and they're like,
go.
And then you're like, dropping. Yeah. Like, no, I'm not ready. Go. You're ready. Like,
I mean, like, can you imagine God. A bunch of firefighters or, you know, the EMTs that roll up in the ambulance not having radio contact or the police? I mean, that is just, no.
Like a logistical nightmare.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. What does SNAP stand for? Situation normal, all fucked up. I mean, that's what it is, trying to coordinate a group of five on a big mountain face without radios. Yeah, the situation might be normal, but it is all fucked up.
Yeah, that sounds tricky. That sounds V-tricky. I'm glad we're not doing that anymore.
Yeah.
I like my radio.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, let's wrap this one up before it gets too long.
All right.
So what do you want to
leave them with?
What do you want to give people?
All right. Here's your actionable advice. Travel techniques don't trump bad terrain decisions. And at some point in your career, you may need to call for a chopper or dig in for the night instead of push through and be really wary. I mean, this is a huge red flag when someone says, oh, screw it. We'll just go one at a time. It'll be fine. No. Because one person avalanched is way too many. And then anytime we're in avalanche terrain, we want to continue to add our risk treatments. So if we're going on the uphill and, oh, we're doing kick turns. Hey, we're in avalanche terrain. Or ideally just a little bit before we get into avalanche terrain, we're going to spread out to lessen our impact on the slope. And then it's only like 300 pounds bouncing up and down instead of, say, 1,500 pounds. And we have to be real careful on the switchbacks that we maintain that school bus distance so that our stress bubbles don't overlap. And then on the downhill, ideally, we're riding one at a time in avalanche terrain. And we're using our terrain choices to look for a smooth planar slope that's survivable. And then we do our hockey stick at the bottom. So we're out of the line of fire, hopefully. And ideally, if we can find a raised ridge or some old growth trees, that's a much lower risk option. And there's a tension between being far enough out of the runout zone for the day's anticipated avalanche size and being close enough to respond to your group. But you kind of have to go with protecting the group members. I think more emphasis on that, because the worst case scenario is one person gets avalanched, but then five people are regrouped way too close and get smoked.
Right. It's always, you would rather have people be a little further away, but be out of the runout zone.
Exactly.
So that they can come assist.
Yeah. We want to avoid that multiple burial scenario at all costs. All right. And then we've got a couple different techniques. When we're in the trees, we want to be protected above, but also a tree right below us that could pin us, that we're real close and we're hugging it. And it's, our bindings are right up against the tree, so we don't get spun out of there. Leapfrogging can be a lot of fun when you've got to roll over or you're in the forest with limited visibility. And that person whose air traffic control goes in the middle of the slope and ideally off to the side, so they're out of the line of fire. And then in special cases, when you're in really steep terrain, instead of having the group come in above you, you would have them come in below you with the hockey stick so you don't get sloughed out.
Well, heck yeah, man. That was like the boom, 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 boom checklist of all of them.
And
like
right to be there. Fair, there are plenty of times when we don't ski one at a time when we're out riding together. But it's if we're going to party ski, it's because we're out of avalanche terrain. And we're like, let's go for it. Yeah.
Right. Below 30.
Yep.
Well, sweet, man. Thanks for hopping on this one. I even though we mostly ski tour together, so like I know a lot of this stuff, it's still always interesting getting that extra layer of input when we're not on the skin track. I feel like I absorb this stuff a lot more than when I'm like cold and sweaty and running around with camera gear and insert all these other distractions.
Yeah, and to be fair, when we're riding great powder, it's pretty easy to forget this stuff because it's quite a lot to hold in your head.
That's true.
Yeah.
It's very easy to get excited about the chowder.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, man. Well, great talking to you. And I think we're wrapped up on this one. I'll see you next week, eh?
I'll see you next week in the backcountry, Dave.
All right, peace out, brother.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to All Aspects. If you like what we're doing here, please leave a rating and review. It really is the best way to help others find the show. Thanks again to our business daddy, Aspect Abbey, for making this show possible. To learn more about how Aspect Abbey is making avalanche safety simple, go to aspectabbey.com. If you want to use this powerful new tool on your next backcountry adventure, simply download the app from the App Store and enjoy 30 days free on them. Lastly, a special thanks to Ice Lab for helping us produce this show. You guys rock, and we couldn't do it without you. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you in the backcountry.